Hi, and welcome to the Cloud Computing Show, episode number 34. It is Roundtable Week here, and most importantly, we have a special guest in from overseas, Sam Johnston from Google. Sam, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
We'll do the quick introductions around the table and then give you a chance to tell us some more about yourself. We also have Brian Bukowski, the CEO of CitrusLeaf. Hi, Brian.
Good to see you, Gary.
Same here. And James Waters, the Senior Manager of vCloud Solutions at VMware and gracious host of the conference room where we are now.
Hey, James. Howdy, Gary.
Hello. So, Sam, since it's your first time on the show, we're really happy to have you. Give us a 1 minute bio so folks can learn a little bit more about yourself.
All right. Well, look, so if you didn't work it out, I'm Australian. I've been in Europe for half a dozen years now. I spent a couple of years in Dublin and Paris, making my way to Zurich, where I'm based now at the... And I guess you'd call it Google's engineering headquarters. And there, I work on the site reliability engineering team. It's a bit of a mouthful. And I work on building out the infrastructure and so on. So now getting into cloud building rather than what I was doing before, which is helping large enterprises get into the cloud, which I started doing in 2006.
And lots of work around cloud standards and such, which we'll talk about as well.
Right. Yes, of course. And open cloud and various cloud standards and so on too.
Yeah, we're going to get into that after we go through some of the industry news. There's a ton of industry news over the last few weeks, and I have a long list of stories. We'll try to get through as many as we can, but it's been about a month since we had the roundtable, and one of the stories that happened since then is the Eucalyptus funding, $20 million in funding. No small crackers there. James, what do you think?
Ran into Martin Mikos at Structure, quiet guy. Doesn't say much. Spent 10 years building MySQL to the point that it sold for $1 billion. Wasn't one of those Mark Benioffs, right?
Yeah.
That was always out there waving his hands and shooting fireworks out of his fingers.
Not so much self-promotion there.
You know, I think that they've made a really, really big investment in Martin, and I guarantee you that this funding was part of bringing him there.
Yeah.
And frankly, Martin could have funded that himself.
Sure.
If he wanted to. So I think that there's two big bets that have been made on Eucalyptus funding. They're moderately, mildly sort of kind of a competitor, so I hate to say this, but the back channel I keep hearing is that their open source product runs into scalability issues, and I keep wanting to believe that it doesn't, and I keep wanting to find this alternative case, but from the NASA Nebula guys to some other, everywhere I go, I hear whispers of this. So I'm really curious to see how this big funding and big CEO meet with, you know, this tech that they actually have, and like how those two things come together.
I don't think we've hit the deployment stage of that company yet. At least I haven't seen it. You know, you don't hear about the dozens of case studies and, we're not there quite yet.
They say that they have 13,000 downloads, essentially, which is bundled in with Ubuntu. They can monitor that out of Ubuntu Package Manager. But anyone who's ever, looked at Package Manager statistics, for instance, when MySQL was at its peak, it was getting 40,000 a day.
Yeah, yeah.
So 13,000 collective package gets or et cetera into deployment. It's
a long way from download to customer, regardless, no matter what part of the world or business you're in. So
the good thing you can say is that lots of people are talking about them.
Well, I think another thing as well is that we're not really going to know a lot of this because a lot of the deployments today are actually pilots.
Yeah.
And, you know, the same applies to amateur cloud in general. we're talking about tens or hundreds of virtual machines, you know, not necessarily large deployments. I mean, I've rolled it out myself, and I was generally fairly pleased. I think, you know, for someone who's familiar with Amazon, it actually does make a lot of sense, and obviously it's got the same APIs and things. So I quite like the product, and I'm glad to see.
I think it fits a very, aside from the company specifically, but the product idea and the fit of being able to do and have total control over
awesome.
A Amazon compatible cloud is
and they hired
spot
Mitch,
on.
Mitch Garnett, who is the awesome, you know, low profile but really smart, hardworking innovator behind Boto language, which is probably the number one systems admin language for Amazon right now, and they brought him over, which is super smart to bring.
I mean, some people say that deploying a private cloud with Eucalyptus is actually going to help boost public cloud adoption. What do you guys think about that?
Well, it's a helpful step for transition, isn't it? It's a good first start, and getting your existing workloads virtualized is, of course, the first step into a cloud for a lot of customers.
Yeah.
I don't really see how the investment makes sense. I the idea of putting that much money into open source oriented solutions, I wouldn't put my own money into that kind of solution, even though I do think it's a great product. I like the product too. I like the guys. But I don't see how there's going to be an $800 million exit out of that.
Yeah. This is fat startup. This is not lean startup.
It's fat startup. And, you know, there might be an exit where, you know, who knows who's going to buy them. Maybe it's Oracle. They've not really been pushing with great cloud technology so far. It might be someone. But I think that they would be a going concern with the kind of revenues that would support the kind of investment at this level? MySQL at its heyday was only pulling in, I think, about $50, maybe $60 million a year.
Yep. Yeah.
So I don't see how you justify this kind of investment.
And I think the...
But don't get me wrong, I'm happy to see guys getting the money and I'm happy to see great products being built.
It's worthy taking a look at how Martin managed the openness of MySQL.
Well, I was about to say, what's your take on the MySQL then?
In my book, it's not an open product. Because in order to be a contributor, you had to sign away all the IP rights. If I contribute to a product and I don't even own the thing that the code that I wrote, that was a choice for me for not contributing. I mean, so the guys who made the money off the sale of that company were not necessarily the contributors. Some of them made some money, some of them didn't. That's a part of MySQL that's always stuck in my craw a little bit.
Yeah.
Well, there's a lot of products that have CLAs, and that's quite important for a company that's trying to make money from a commercial product as well. And this whole
Absolutely.
Open core trend that we're seeing as well, that's retaining or at least getting a perpetual license to the contributions is very important.
Because otherwise you can't actually sell the product. I mean,
you need
to have the core IP, absolutely.
Well,
but why wouldn't then every single contributor be receiving stock constantly?
That's what MySQL did. They would sell OEM licenses with a different license to people because they retained that. And they're like, oh, you want us to... Anyway, this is exactly what you guys are talking to, but I think Martin was brought in to execute on a open core, not quite open business model, and brought in as the expert of that. And I've heard that their enterprise product is starting to avoid some of the scalability issues.
Well, if you look at Linux, there's no way that you can actually do that because there's so many contributors and there's no one party that owns the contributions. And this has stopped them, obviously it was a contentious issue, but moving to GPL v3,
mm-hmm.
even if they wanted to do it, now certainly I believe Mozilla managed to pull it off with Firefox, but it's a lot more complicated.
Well, we're going to save some time to talk about open core, open source a little bit later in the show, so let's move on to the next topic. Another acquisition that took place, a lot of acquisitions this past few weeks. Dell bought Scalent doing some kind of dynamic provisioning for virtual machines and hypervisors. We couldn't quite make out the...
Read the front page.
No, I'm not going to read the front page on the website.
Awesome,
no, I don't.
We had this awesome sidebar before the show where we read the marketing verbatim. So everyone go out to the site and read it. And no comment.
It won't be, the Scalent website might not be up by the time the show gets out. Let me ask you this question. Was this a strategic move or was this Dell, which they've done in the past, picking up some intellectual property on the cheap, because I don't think the acquisition price was announced.
Well, how does this compare with what they do with Joyent? Because they also announced that they're going to start selling Joyent Stack.
Right.
So are they just going to be resellers of provisioning technology and hope that one of them takes off as a private cloud?
I don't know. I mean, I think the broader context, Dell has lost a lot of their luster in the last few years, and I don't know people who look to Dell for strategic advice on doing architectures, and I mean, I just don't hear about it anymore, that the way somebody might do that with one of the larger OEM providers, but...
Okay, well, look, I will say this. It's certainly more strategic than registering the cloud computing trademark.
So good for them. I mean, at least they're doing something, right? I mean...
So I hear more about Dell from my Asian friends and the build-outs that they're doing in China and some of the custom hardware their cloud group is doing, sort of taking... Atom architectures and putting them really close to the drives in order to decrease power spend in particular, which is difficult in Asian countries. But yeah, here it seems like a string of acquisitions. And what are they up to now?
Dell's using Atom servers in Asia?
That's what I hear.
I didn't know that. That's the whole CMicro play to some extent.
CMicro and what's the other company doing some work?
Wasn't a highly reliable source. Maybe I shouldn't say.
Well, we'll see.
I mean, rumors are fair game.
Rumors are fair game. All right, let's move on. IBM bought Big Fix. Did anybody follow that? Pay attention to that. So, Big Fix has got some software that helps in highly distributed computing environment, geographically distributed, going sort of ferret out information and sort of like an IT management monitoring solution. So that may have some applicability to clouds, particularly when you're in multi-cloud environments across geographies. I think it was a sizable acquisition, but I don't have the exact figure off the top of my head. So
the only thing I'd say there is that IBM intends to take on problems that it doesn't see a radical solution coming soon. So when it bought the integration engine, Cast Iron. When it bought Cast Iron, it's sort of a constant data integration engine, and you're never going to solve the data integration problem, and you're never going to solve the management problem. And I think IBM has to stay in businesses of complexity, given their model, to charge the premiums that they want over time. They don't want to get into anything that resembles a commodity.
Right.
I think they've decided that data integration and management are two areas that will never quite be solved. And that's just my reflex to that.
Yeah.
So if you go to the Big Fix site, they say that it's faster, smarter systems management. And it's basically endpoint management for a large number of devices that are deployed
right.
in the field. Now, if you think about the problem of having to manage clients and mobile phones and all sorts of other devices, you don't want them calling back into an enterprise server. You know, you really want the clouds are a really great option for that, because you know you can deploy these kind of patches yeah. to like a CDN, and then you're pulling down the patch from a server that's really close to you. So in that sense, I think that technologically it makes a lot of sense to do patching like that. Whether the Big Fix product, I mean, I haven't touched it. I don't know the first thing about it, but I know that I've had headaches before with patch management.
Yeah, well, yeah, and they're dealing with customers who have millions of devices all over the place, and I guess that's the particular fit for where the software was in place. We'll have a link to the IBM news release in the show notes. Two big data news items, one funding, one acquisition. So the first was Palantir raising $90 million.
The end of IPOs is upon us, right?
The end of IPOs is upon us. Well, if you're a hot social networking property, you can raise $100 million plus from DST, and if you're a hot big data company, you can raise $100 million right here in Silicon Valley, I guess. I spent a little bit, I started hearing about Palantir a few weeks ago from friends just saying this is a company that you should pay attention to, and then the funding hit. But they really haven't been part of the big data conversation. And so I guess they've been, busily just closing deals. And
if you look at the way they approach the market, it's all about end user exposure and visualization and making this work for humans.
Mm-hmm.
So they're sort of the human interface to big data. And I think that's one of the reasons they haven't got as much nerd cred, is because that's not a very nerd cred way to approach the market. At the same time, if you're selling to governments or people with sort of modestly advanced user base, or you want to solve problems, that's not a bad approach. I wish I knew more about their technology stack underneath it that they use to execute on that.
Well, you can follow the link in the show notes. The other data-related acquisition was the EMC acquisition of Greenplum, which I heard on the web rumors of $300 million, $400 million, which is no small potatoes.
You have to remember how much they raised, though.
Okay, how much did they raise?
I think they raised, 60?
Okay.
So that's only a 5x multiple.
Oh, if it was 300, yeah. Yeah, I mean, they've been around for a while.
Been around for a while.
And I think doing reasonably well. The thing that got to me a little bit was the mixing of big data and cloud regarding Greenplum, because I haven't really looked at Greenplum as a very cloud-oriented offering in the past, but...
They have a cluster.
Yeah, they have a cluster.
They have more than one machine that works
right.
together.
And
I was at Sun, I did some Greenplum deals.
Yeah.
And people that were doing big chunks of clickstream data, so very large social networking sites, not Facebook, but
right.
other ones you can imagine, and very large stock exchanges were two examples of who people were using to collect data dust with Greenplum.
Right.
And they were very good at using commodity hardware to collect data, to be a data warehouse and also an analysis engine.
And the other thing which I think they've figured out some things to really add to the whole problem solving here is a lot of big data processing and compute capability and a relatively small hardware footprint. So compared to the Hadoop strategy where it's just you just keep adding machines to your heart's content, I think with Greenplum they had put in the intelligence and the software to get a little bit more out of a smaller hardware footprint. Sam, give us your comment on that one.
Well, look, I mean, you know my opinion about cloud. You know, if it's not a service, it's not cloud as far as I'm concerned. So
yeah, I don't think it was a very cloud, but they're getting swept up in the whole thing.
Look, they've got a lot of different components there. They've got a whole lot of parallelizing. They've got fault tolerance. They do some map-reduced work. They've got there's a whole lot of stuff that they do. It's a really interesting product. One could call it cloud washing, I think.
I don't know that anyone's directly called it cloud. I think that they had very A-list customers.
Yeah.
And I think they had a new technology, and I think for a space that doesn't have a lot of new players, or they're of the few people that have really come up and that have grabbed A-list with a moderate amount of marketing. And I think that given that in the consolidation mode that some companies are in, it makes sense to buy a company like GreenPlum to get customer attention.
Well, before I accuse them of cloud washing, I'm just saying that on the basis that they're actually on this sheet here. So if they're not making the claims themselves.
No, I don't think they were making the claims themselves. I think that as the story came out, it became a cloud story because, almost everything gets swept up in that
theme.
They
were tied up to VBlock, so they were at least a modular story of saying that it might be like a VBlock.
I stand corrected. They're talking about the enterprise data cloud, so guilty as charged.
Okay. Let me add one thing. I think that trend I've really been seeing over the last 3 to 6 months especially is the rolling engine of Hadoop crushing all in its path. And
yeah.
To me, the price that EMC paid, I would call dumb money. The product is a very interesting product. I've met with the guys before. Great technology. The customer list, as you say, is particularly good. On the other hand, most of my friends have been veering much closer to Netezza. So when you look at Netezza's solution, actually a box that fits in your data center and just crunches data, it's sort of the far opposite. You want to get real density. You want to go Netezza and get something that is even further away from Hadoop. So a lot of people swing in Hadoop.
And I'm pretty sure this morning I saw a news announcement about Netezza and Hadoop. Was it with Cloudera? Did you see it this morning? So, it basically talking about the wave of commercialization of Hadoop. And as you say, like, there's more and more connectors and things being swept up into that ecosystem that are making it shinier and more appealing for traditional enterprise folks to jump in.
Yeah, here we go. We've got Cloudera and Netezza team up to bring Hadoop to customers.
Yeah, so that just came out this morning. I didn't have a chance to put it in the show notes. But this, to your statement, it's a steamroller. And are they going to counter that steamroller with this?
I think the GreenPlum guys made a good bet of getting out of the way, and hopefully they're pocketing a fair amount of it.
Yeah,
I wonder how much of this buy was usability, though. I mean, I see some interesting tweets out of people that kind of back and forth on Hadoop that for the high-end guys, the guys that are doing Facebook and looking at the ads, and these very educated, hardcore computer scientists that, Hadoop is awesome. But for your average business analyst at a company who wants to analyze some data or work with it, the query language of Hadoop is way beyond them. And
I don't know if it's way beyond them. I mean, MapReduce is not complicated. It's just different.
Yeah, it's not the functionality set that they're used to. And
I was going to leave this for later in the show, but if we're going to talk Hadoop, the one thing I'm also hearing from my friends is, do you know any Hadoop guys?
Exactly.
Anyone who can pick up a book and read about Hadoop for a week has got probably 7 or 8 job offers coming in. And I don't think it is so much the fact that it's a hard technology necessarily, but simply if you think about all the DBAs in the world, hundreds of thousands of DBAs making a lot of money, well, there probably needs to be about the same number of Hadoop guys as there needs to be DBAs, except there's currently thousands of Hadoop guys. So that needs to grow by, good order of magnitude as Hadoop is coming up.
How long does it take? I mean, if you're an enterprise company, right? Like, you go through this at an enterprise, you're like, I want to hire this skill set. I know how hard it is to hire cloud skill set, right? It's not easy.
Yeah, no, it's going to take years.
I think in the intervening time, things with a traditional query language, a traditional setup,
I agree.
Have a pretty good cash cow.
EMC is in the business of making money, not necessarily promoting new technologies. Cool. App Innovator, anybody see that? Sort of cute, build your own Android app. Don't need to know any code. No?
I don't do cellular, Gary.
I thought it was interesting. It was just a little thing. I wanted to include it, but we'll move on.
It's an interesting product. Everything I say today is, of course, my own opinion. But the first thing I thought when I saw this was was Apple's HyperCut. You know, and this was a really great product for creating some fairly niche but interesting education applications, training. I think that there's and if you read the article, you'd say it's that everyone who's asked about it says it's got great potential. And I think that really, it's not going to get any worse, that's for sure.
Yeah.
So already we've got basic building blocks. There's Twitter in there and stuff. So I think it'll be interesting to see what people do.
I think the takeaway from this, from a cloud computing perspective, was anything that can be done to make application development or tweaking more accessible to more users with the combination of having a public cloud resource to scale that as needed is kind of neat. And I think the ability, you know, for folks to just get on the website, don't have to know Python necessarily, and be able to do the equivalent of a basic app engine app is really. I haven't had a chance to play with it yet, but I'm gonna. I mean, I have a few little things like, oh, it'd be cool to have this widget, it'd be cool to have that widget, and I'm gonna see if I can do it with App Innovator.
Has anyone else heard that Apple was filtering out these template apps though? Like, I've heard that Apple took some steps to say these basic template apps that were based on a very simple construct that maybe you could replicate it as something else. And they were
what does Apple have to do with cloud computing?
Well, they were.
I'm just giving you your own medicine, man.
You're right, actually. But
your own medicine.
We're talking about phones. I'm doing my best here.
If I understand well, what was happening there was that there was all of these applications that were popping up that were like a single website or a single subject that were like a feed, and then they'd throw some ads on it and they'd call that a new application.
Yeah.
That's not really what we're talking about here. When you're developing a product, it's best to have the developer as close as possible to the person with the itch that needs to be scratched. You know, and if they're one and the same, then that's great. And that's
right.
Why Excel is so popular, you know, because the people who have the problem can actually fix the problem themselves.
Right. It's a very tight loop.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Well,
interesting.
I also see this as a big difference between the Android ecosystem and the iPhone ecosystem.
Sure.
So with iPhone, they did want to ban that because there's this sea of applications
they didn't
you can't
want application
find
clutter
looking for because they can't figure out a good navigational metaphor to allow you to sell apps.
Yeah.
So Android's taking a much more open approach, and I think it's great to have two players and, you know, a completely different approach that is...
This kind of thing is going to get more people using more public clouds directly or indirectly than you know, any of this Apple stuff.
If we're just going to talk about this for a minute, and it's not very cloudy, I agree. Do you see the one about Microsoft actually paying for Windows 7 mobile? So they're actually out there saying, you know, we'll give you a notebook and $500 if you write, you know, some little app for us.
Isn't that the ultimate proof that there's no money to be made in their ecosystem? Isn't it like a big signal? Do not. I mean, found a company, you're going to found a company based on getting a free notebook?
That was like Bing paying all those things for the searching and buying and getting kickbacks from Bing when you bought something through a click-through.
It's can't buy me love, just only in mobile phones.
Okay, well, here is a Microsoft story that is very cloudy, is the Windows Azure appliance. Sam, what do you have to say about that?
Well, look, that's very interesting because... I'm just looking at an article here from Information Week from March, and it says Microsoft nixes private Azure clouds. Microsoft won't allow businesses to run locally hosted versions of its forthcoming Windows Azure cloud operating system. And the exact quote is, "We don't envision something on our price list called Windows Azure that is sold for on-premises deployment." That's March.
And what are we now?
No,
July?
Sorry. No, great. That was March 2009. So we're talking a year.
Okay, so a year. Okay, fine.
Now, maybe that's just adapting to what the market's asking for, or I don't know. I mean, that's just...
I think it's inevitable. I mean, the traditional enterprises want private cloud stuff so badly. It's not logical. I don't think there are always these grand cost-value analyses that take place. It's just, I want it locally. And so why would you fight that and not just give the people what they want?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I like Azure. I think it's a very interesting product. I think that making like a CLR available that you can deploy whatever you want. You want to deploy your Python and stuff on it, that's fine. I think that's a good way of consuming cloud service. And look, it's no secret that I prefer to talk about platforms and applications rather than infrastructure. I think with infrastructure, the tail's wagging the dog at the moment. But I think it's a bit of a shame that it's kind of being literally, you know, most of the articles talk about it being put in a box, you know, cloud in a box.
You know what, though? The Microsoft ecosystem and the channel ecosystem around Microsoft like selling boxes.
Well, that's true.
And, you know, don't... There was an article on GigaOm by Derek Harris recently, and then I piggybacked on a little bit about don't discount the channel in the cloud. Things that can be sold by the channel without having to train them, without having to have white papers and presentations where the channel can just say, oh, you like this idea of the Microsoft Azure cloud, but you're not ready to put everything over there, get started with this. I mean, that's mainstream IT, at least in the United States, and it's easy for people to sell. And I think that you can't discount that in this particular ecosystem.
I think the viewpoint that we should all be enlightened engineers and find the optimal solution and consume it over the web is what cloud insiders view as the world. And the truth is a lot of people are convinced what to do by somebody who calls them up and takes them to lunch still today.
Sure. But is it better or worse for somebody to use the Windows Azure appliance or just stick with locally attached storage? I mean, it's like virtualization, right? I virtualize my environment, it gets me half a step closer to using the public cloud. I mean, isn't it like a...
I'm going to go a little further. So what we said, you know, Eucalyptus, wow, that sounds really great because you can take all the infrastructure and APIs that you build for EC2 and now you can run it wherever you want and you don't have to be beholden to Amazon. Okay, so Microsoft with Azure is doing roughly the same thing. They're saying you don't have to be tied to our data center, you can take it to your own data center. You can take it to Tahiti. So why would we possibly slam Microsoft for doing something?
Because they said that they weren't going to.
Oh, come on, give me a break.
No,
you never change your mind?
No, look, I mean, honestly.
I'm sorry they're smart.
I've heard whispers and rumors that adoption after the demo period wasn't as high as they wanted. And I think that's obviously going to happen. I mean, cloud is an evolution, right? So you can't expect this immediate hockey stick that everyone suddenly builds all their apps to you. And I think this is a good go-between. But I think if they had rabid adoption of Azure Online,
they wouldn't have done this?
They wouldn't have done it.
I think it's a valid point.
They validated, they broke their business plan. Their business plan did not happen on Azure. Even if it was corporate crap and they overestimated, they broke their business plan, and this is a steer.
Well, you're buying a roadmap as well, right? I mean, it's very important that you find a direction and you stick with it. You go there.
Yeah.
So the thing you're buying when you're buying cloud, though, is the actual operations, I think. You know, the efficiency of the operations. And if it's an actual appliance, like a box, which is a box.
You know, you can buy the box with Dell or with other partners.
But is it? I mean, is it really a box that you get that's got no user serviceable parts? And you plug it in, and if you want 1,000 of them, you buy 1,000 of them. And it's a scalable system like this. You know, that's
yeah. I don't think we know the specifics of the deployment model. I don't even think they know all the specifics yet about how it's going to roll out.
Microsoft has impressive ass data centers. Let's be honest. I mean, when they show out their data centers with like 30 people operating all these machines and these stackable things, they really made a huge investment in the cloud side of this.
And all the cloud leaders do it. Microsoft, Amazon, Twitter, Facebook, Google. It's all about who can operate the data center the most efficiently.
And they made a huge play to say we can be part of that group. And I think the challenge then is after you do that, you still have to bring user demand.
You got
to
sell it.
You got to go out and sell it. And I think that's the cloud challenge right now, is that everyone understands this is happening, but it's the time scale that it's happening over.
And so it wasn't happening fast enough, so they needed to goose revenues by having a channel-friendly Azure appliance? Is that
absolutely. They wanted to kickstart adoption somehow, and it's still useful to be able to just deploy code versus deploying
Now, we could correlate this a little bit with what happened with EMC and Atmos. EMC offering Atmos as a service, offering Atmos to service providers and end-user customers, and then cut the service offering except for development, because they didn't want to compete with channel partners and everything. So I don't think Microsoft is going to cut their Azure offering.
I think that while that's somewhat fair and very stark logic, EMC had never really said, we are going to be this giant online storage monster. It was sort of like, this is a demonstration of what you can do. And their sales motion was always towards, you know, selling it as a technology.
Selling it to AT&T and Savvis.
I get your logic, but I think that the Azure's $2 billion investment in data centers and online is not comparable.
Yeah. Moving on. SaaS funding spree. So in the last couple of days, Squarespace, that does software as a service for building websites and blogs and things like that, $38 million first round of funding. And Atlassian, yeah, first round.
First round?
First round, bootstrapped since 2003, I believe. Yeah, it's Atlassian, also bootstrapped since 2002, I don't have these dates exactly, $60 million funding round. Both were Excel companies. I mean, is this the new model, like bootstrap until you're profitable and then bring in a huge chunk of cash?
Over here.
Yeah, go ahead. That's the citrus leaf model?
Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, it does have something to be said about it. Goodness gracious.
I guess, you know, the cost of creating software now that there's some available tools out there is not that high. And so the real cost is proving that there's adoption of it. And it's hard for a VC to invest just in the idea anymore because so many people can code up ideas.
What do they spend this money on if they've got a proven...
Marketing.
Just sales and marketing.
Sales and marketing.
Yeah.
I think that a lot of...
That and the gold-plated bathtub. I've got mine picked out personally.
And a lot of Apple gear. Startups, once they get big funding, they're always like, here's your 50-inch monitor.
Well, if any Atlassian sales folks are in the Bay Area taking people out to golf games.
Oh, look, I love Atlassian, and not just because they're Australian. I mean, they're not a pure SaaS play. They're a software company first and foremost. But I think, you know, if you look at their videos about their office and stuff, they're very googly. They've got a very similar kind of work ethic and so on. They work really hard, and they churn out these great products.
Yeah.
And, you know,
they are sort of a de facto standard for doing the bug tracking and the development stuff on the programmer side. I mean, we use them.
One of the first to integrate into EC2. I mean, a year ago, they were saying you have to integrate EC2 into your development environment to do automated testing and to just deploy that immediately. So give them a little thought leadership points in that, too.
Yeah, no, they've done a nice job.
They certainly earned it.
Yeah, congratulations to both of those companies. All right, this was a big story this week. Finally, after months and months and months of saying the network has got to get better,
yes,
and the interconnect has got to get better, and the slime mold has got to congeal.
You heard it here on the Cloud Computing Show from this room 4 months, 5 months, 6 months before it happened.
Amazon finally kicks it up a notch and launches EC2 instances with low latency, high performance networking for the cloud. They won't use the word cloud grid, but I will. So what do we think about
that? I'll go
that?
Last, because I could do a whole show on this.
You could do a whole show on it. Well,
I think you should go first in that case.
Yeah, go first.
The first fundamental thing is that they broke two OSS properties here, is that this is a different... So if you have standard security groups or standard network configuration or whatever you do standard, this is different because you have a different network construct. You put them in groups, right?
This is an isolated thing.
Let's be clear.
It's like a sidebar.
This has layer 2 networking connectivity. Remember this big thing I've been talking about for a while that clouds needed, that everyone's like, yeah. This has that, and it also has clustering, which is something else I've said that you need in a cloud to build truly high-performance web apps. So I was involved over the weekend in a debate Saturday morning with Simon Wardley, who's very brilliant chair of the Cloud Summit that's coming next week, and with whom I have the utmost respect. And his viewpoint was just code around everything. All you need to do is provision a commodity node and forget it, right? And that's where the whole world was going to. And Brian wisely has been saying on the show for a while that you actually might not want just a ghetto data center on command. You might want some of these good computing primitives.
Well, we've been talking about networking and I/O issues in the cloud for a while, and people joke about, you know, it's fine if you want to use EC2, just don't expect anything to go quickly over the network.
And how important was it to them? It was important enough that they broke AMI compatibility.
Well, let me ask you a question.
They use a different hypervisor for this.
I know. So one of the things I read online, I don't have the link, but was that people said this was just something that large customers were demanding, and so they just did it. They separated it out of their traditional EC2 development process, put it off on the side and said, hey, we're just going to build this now so they can sell it now. I mean, is this something that gets folded in, or do these maintain distinct development paths?
Pardon me for one more glass of wine comment. God does not need an alternative universe. Like, God does not have to create two universes, because if he does, that means he screwed up the first one. And this is an alternative universe within EC2, which is basically like our first model doesn't fit a lot of use cases. Therefore,
it doesn't fit some use cases.
It's important enough to them that they did it. The point is that they're...
Okay, do they merge them now?
Well, that's...
No, there's always a gated community and a ghetto.
Well, rent's cheaper in the ghetto, right?
Rent's cheaper in the ghetto, and, you know...
Yeah, I mean, you're not going to get spot instances in the high-performance cluster.
It's $1,100 a month per server. Carl Brooks.
Wow.
did that little math and tweeted out. He's like, guys, are you aware this is $1,100 a month per server for this thing?
Right.
Amortize that over 3 years.
Right.
Commodity, but, Warner, commodity.
Yeah. So, Sam, what do you think?
Look, I think it's a great idea. There's certain specialized applications, and I think if you charge, and obviously this costs a lot more to deliver this kind of service. Many applications are embarrassingly parallel, like web serving, for example, especially static web serving. You just run it on a whole lot of commodity nodes. You use load balancing, DNS load balancing, however you want to do it. But you can just keep scaling that thing forever. Now, certain applications, HPC in particular, and anything doing matrices and stuff, you require that very fast interconnect, and that's what they're offering. There's a market, they're providing it, good on.
Yeah, so let's see what happens in next year. Are they going to merge these things? Is it just going to be another drop down?
What does EC2 want to be when it grows up? Does it want to be this very unified kind of platform? Or does it want to be like a warehouse of books, which is what they sell on the other side? Like, have you ever seen a picture of Amazon? It's like every book in the world with a robot that gets you what you want. And people have complained for a while that the EC2 API is already fragmented. Like, S3 isn't that comparable to EC2. And I think the danger that Amazon runs into is they start to look like a warehouse of books for compute versus sort of this unified.
They're going to look like a Fortune 10 enterprise data center.
Oh, where's the electricity? I mean, sorry to say, Sam, but, this is, I guess, what, 220? Is that the equivalent? Or where an electricity model, what is this?
How do you mean the as in?
Oh, well, you can't talk about 120, 220 with somebody who's necessarily, unless live in the U.S. and all the power stuff.
Oh, right? Sorry. Yeah. But Sam and I have had some discussions before about cloud as electricity and
if the standard plug is 120 volts and you don't need special power.
It's three phase.
It's three phase power, right? Goodness.
There's another problem here, which is this is where I have my little prop, which is. We're in danger of being strangled by cloud APIs, I believe. And part of what's happening here is the EC2 model, based on how they do their networking and what those APIs are, we might get stuck with having this one monolithic API and one set of monolithic ways to provision services, and it becomes super hard to make a generational change like Amazon is trying to do. Now, what I have in my hand here is a new third generation of SSDs. I know the guys doing the chips. This is 2x cheaper and 4x denser. And this little guy will do 50,000 transactions a second. It's 250 times faster than a rotational disk.
So
that's an enterprise drive.
So this is an SSD drive in a 2.5-inch laptop kind of form factor. It doesn't say how much capacity is it.
That's 100 gigger, but that's the small baby brother. And that's one of the exciting things is that these guys are doing 400 gig parts. Now, the way they do it is what they're calling Enterprise MLC. The company that's building the chips is a company, Sandvine, not to be confused with Sandvine peer-to-peer piracy software, Sandvine the chip company. They're down in the valley. Part of the problem here is that OCZ, the company that makes it...
Sam's going to try to jam it into his MacBook Pro.
OCZ is going to have a lot of trouble selling into the enterprise market because who the hell's ever heard of OCZ? But
it doesn't weigh anything.
It weighs nothing. And so you can get a 400 gig capacity drive. You can put four of these things in a $5,000 server, and you've got more I/O than you could possibly imagine for disk. And where am I going to get that at a cloud provider today?
Aki had this construct, right?
Well, I mean, we had the had the ability to specify the performance of various resources, disk and network and CPU resources, and it wasn't, I want DDR3 or SSD, it was, I want so many gigabits per second or something like this. Now, that's the API, but you then need implementations that support it. So they need to buy this stuff, and, I wouldn't say that they're going to retrofit SSD across their whole fleet tomorrow.
No, but I would like to have a construct in the most prominent cloud API that allows me. If they decide to deploy this in EC2, I couldn't even buy this because there's not really a way to express it.
This is the slime mold, metaphor that actually Shlomo Swidler, who's a brilliant cloud practitioner, came up with sitting in my office upstairs. He's like, EC2 today is kind of like slime mold, is that it's a very basic construct with massive parallelism, and it's all the same. And you just orchestrate that together, and that's what it is. And once you want to start doing these kind of things... And I think the answer of everything is just solved in an embarrassingly parallel way, you're a pretty hardcore practitioner of data, and it doesn't always work for you.
No, and I want to be able sometimes to specify, I need one of these versus one of these. I don't think the API is that hard, but we got stuck in this very simple model. Amazon had to roll something out. They've been brilliant about putting together features, you know, just rolling them out month after month after month. Very relentless march of, you know, new features, new cloud features, new cloud APIs. But what happens when we get stuck with one that really doesn't allow us to move forward? They're going to have to then create a walled city and then a ghetto over here. Because
that's why I found the announcement such a big deal.
Me too. I agree completely.
Well, the Amazon API is kind of like the PHP of programming languages. It's all a flat namespace. They just keep adding whatever they need to add, which, to be honest, the last thing you want, and this is where there's this whole discussion, is it too early to standardize? The last thing you want is to kind of throw a big wet blanket over the innovation. And one of the things that I've tried very hard to do with any of the APIs I've worked on is to focus on extensibility, knowing that we're not there yet.
So you're saying don't rush to standardization yet.
Well, no, I think it's important. I mean, you either do it right and extensible, or you deal with something like the Amazon API until things settle a little bit, because really things are moving so quickly. We've got VPC coming in. We've got this new HPC stuff coming in. Once it settles, then you can go and say, okay, let's go to the IETF and write like a, you know, an internet standard for this.
But it's too early right now.
Writescale can't even keep up with them, let alone
problem,
a standards
problem
body.
Right now is it's both too early and too late.
Yeah.
That's my concern.
So the internet was done before the internet started. Let's not forget that.
Exactly. And same thing here. The cloud APIs, the horse is out of the gate, I think. And it's going to be very hard. The good news, I think, are some of the companies, possibly like VMware, who are just a little bit on the trailing edge and have slightly more extensible APIs. But I don't know.
So your comment before about EC2 and their dominance on the API front was, are we going to get stuck with a set of APIs that doesn't give us the full functionality of what's capable given the underlying technology?
That's my concern. You know, maybe it's all going to be handled by instance classes, and we're going to, you know, put bit fields on top of instance classes, and so I'll be able to have uppercase and lowercase names or something. I don't know.
But, that's a horrible implementation, Brian.
Well, I'm a hacker at heart.
Well, so the problem is, it's technically possible to add whatever we want to add, but at the moment, what gets added is basically up to Amazon. So what we, I think, will eventually do is maybe revisit this, or, you know, hopefully one day they'll contribute their existing API to a standards body, and then we can get, you know, other people involved. But today, and I'll give you the example that comes to mind, is if we want to add a function to migrate, let's say VMware wants to add a function to migrate to a private cloud. Now, maybe it's not in their interests. So the only option you've got without a community consensus, an open community consensus process, is to fork the standard.
Right.
Maybe Eucalyptus is going to help. I mean, if there is an emerging EC2-based open community out there, maybe that, you know, the standards there can sometimes...
Let's drill in on that. How does Eucalyptus now, which was built to be a certain way, suddenly implement the HPC API? Let's really challenge that somehow the API is going to proliferate in the enterprise. Now you've got to set up... I mean, suddenly Eucalyptus has to support HPC clusters?
Well, you shouldn't have to support everything, you know, and this is one of the things that we worked on with Oki was to make sure that any of the extensions weren't required.
Yeah.
You know, and even the base, even things like the state model, you know, we want that to be extensible. So if we choose a state model that doesn't fit your system, all of a sudden you can't use our API. All of that stuff is completely extensible.
Cool. I want to move on, but I want to get the one last story. We had an announcement, even as a VMware employee, you can fill us in on the new vSphere stuff that came out.
Yeah, I'll put the hammer down for one feature I really liked from the home team, which was they did, and I'm so excited about it, they did I/O control for storage.
Yeah.
And if there's one thing, there's two things that I've been hammering on that the cloud really needed, which was layer two networks that allow proximal node-to-node connection with low latency for messaging-based architectures.
So sort of like rack location awareness kind
which Hadoop,
of stuff?
Which HDFS has,
frankly. Yeah.
It's not a radical VMware idea. And the second thing was that you really needed some damn way of solving the noisy neighbor problem, because it shouldn't be that CPU and memory are limited, but I/O is a wild west.
Yeah.
And I think that's really hurt QoS and SLA in EC2. And I responded to some people that were tweeting about that with news of this. The news is that you can now, on storage I/O, do a hard partition just like you can with CPU and memory to make sure that you don't overconsume the outbound I/O when you're grabbing storage.
It's not a crapshoot anymore. You really get
it's some. Not a crapshoot. It really looks more like a server with its own dedicated storage, which is what I think the cloud, if you think about long term, whosever cloud it is, has to get to.
I mean, it certainly helps for some applications. I think there are applications, like I said, the embarrassingly parallel applications. If you've got a web server and you've got a noisy neighbor next door, what's going to happen is your performance is going to drop. And if you've got half sensible load balancing, it's just going to take you out of the rotation or send you less requests.
Agree that in the pure slime mold model of cloud where everything is embarrassingly parallel, you just add another node and you can solve anything you can solve with parallelism, you don't need QoS. I mean, that's kind of like a rule, right?
Right.
Those two, they're enemies. They don't need each other. But so many applications that people are doing, especially the database tier in EC2, right?
Yeah.
Databases are not embarrassing parallel in a lot of implementations. In Brian's case, they are, smart man that he is. But there's MySQL is like the number one workload on EC2. And so I think the noisy neighbor thing hurts them.
I think that over the next year or so, we're going to see a lot more fine-tuning and granularity and network tweaking and I/O tweaking and qualities of service and maybe instances that are delineated by the reserved bandwidth from a networking and I/O perspective.
It's not going to get worse, that's for sure. It's only upwards from here.
Yeah.
So I did hear one good rumor today, which was that GoGrid is turning away nearly half of their customers when they go into a customer situation and say, okay, what does your workload look like, blah, blah, blah. Half of them they turn away because they can't get enough database IOs at a reasonable price to put it on the cloud.
Well, don't forget that GoGrid also has a colo business, that they'll happily put that person in colo.
Well, right. That's a good point.
And
too.
I think they do. And
so
I think they do.
They're not exactly an unbiased vendor.
And I think they do bare metal provisioning as well.
And they also have their own stack, which may have its own limitations as well, because they do their own message routing. But still, it's a sign, I think.
If MySQL is one of the biggest loads on EC2, which everything I look at, if you look at the top 15 used write-scale templates, MySQL and EBS are all over them.
Right.
That's why I think the noisy neighbor issue really matters, because if your database is doing sinusoidal behavior, you're not happy.
Okay, so there's one other thing as well. You mentioned bare metal. I don't see any reason at all why you can't have a bare metal cloud service. And there's companies like...
New servers.
Yeah, exactly.
New servers, yep.
You know, and on the other side, so then you don't have any noisy neighbors because you don't have any neighbors at all.
And it's like the Montana ranch approach to cloud.
But then on the other side, something that we haven't really seen a great deal of, there's an entire industry of VPS providers out there, but we don't really see any containers like Solaris containers and stuff in the cloud. And I think that's something, if it doesn't change because providers bring it, something else that Amazon announced was the ability to run your own kernel. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that's been missing is the ability to run container LXC and stuff. And I think that's gonna change some things.
They even hinted at an announcement. They said, you might be able to run free BSD. We're not sure, we think. And that has containers within it, if I'm not.
Well, I mean, there's containers in Linux and stuff as well. So, you know,
But FreeBSD has the ability to do some partitioning.
Yeah, FreeBSD, from my understanding, has one of the best and lowest overhead container.
Yeah.
You know, so instead of like $72 a month or whatever it is today, it could be a bit less than that. You know, I mean, you can sell a container for a couple of bucks a month and still make a profit.
Yeah.
No, I think we need this. I certainly need this. A lot of people I talk to need this. This is another example of getting stuck in the cloud where I have serious problems with the CentOS 5 releases that are now prevalent, the 2.6.18 that was state-of-the-art 4 years ago. The 2.6.32 that's going to be part of CentOS 6 and RHEL 6, those are all much more modern, but the amount of work going in to support today's generation of, first of all, those SSDs, second of all, the processor and memory architectures, it's just a light year ahead. 2.6.35 is looking to be an excellent, excellent vintage. And where am I going to get that stuff
fruity
on the cloud? Fruity with a certain steely aspect.
Barnished.
And this is starting to bug me more and more, that the cloud feels like 3 years ago, and I don't like it.
But this is an AMI problem. I'm sorry. Like, not to take, the home team thing, but OS compatibility is generally better on some platforms than just on pure Amazon. So this is... You can put a lot more operating systems.
I'm even having this problem in private installs, where everyone says CentOS 5 and everyone's running Xen and they're running the flavor of Xen and they're running Chef and Puppet on top, very cloud-oriented service architectures. And still, they're like, oh, CentOS 5 or nothing, CentOS 5 or nothing. Bare metal is a week's worth of wait to flip a couple servers over. And the amount of benefit that you get out of it. In the old days, we used to have NetBoot. And you could flip a server by going in and popping in and just changing its NetBoot. That wasn't entirely uncloudy.
Well, the good news here is we're witnessing every single day more maturity in what's being offered publicly. So we got a lot to look forward to.
And that's the step back I would take. I mean, I like advocating for an engineering war in the cloud. I think that benefits everybody. I like a good fight. And my least favorite thing in all of this is the idea that somehow Amazon in 2009 solved the whole puzzle and we all just need to go home, fold our tent, and shut the hell up.
There's a lot to do still.
Yeah.
Well, there was a provider in France that would offer this bare metal service. They were called Dedibox, if I remember well. And it was like €30 a month would get you a dedicated, very small machine. But it was good for certain. You could basically do whatever you want with it. They'd netboot it. It was fully automated. It could have been a VPS for all you knew, but you were the only one on that box.
Yeah.
And Adrian, who's not here, I once jokingly on the show called him J Metal, not J Cloud.
Server hugger.
Yeah, because he is actually a fan of bare metal in many regards.
Being able to provision bare metal is sort of the ultimate because you get all these benefits of instant on, instant off, this and that, but none of the headache of a multi-tenancy.
But I don't know what you guys think, but I actually think that shared storage is the bigger bottleneck. Yeah, it's cute that you can boot up a single server that's performant, but how do you get access to a reliably global storage at high performance?
We're going to save that. We're going to save that for another show. That's a good topic.
Well, my quick question then is how many serious cloud providers are actually using shared storage and not local?
We're going to do the shared storage debate on another show.
You're the expert here.
That's a good one. That's a good one. And and there's a couple of new cool hot startups that we want to get involved with that. Let's shift to some of the roundtable topics. We're running long on the show, but if we go over on this show, so be it. We got special guests in from overseas, and just stick with us because it's going to be worth it. Here's the first roundtable topic that I want to talk about. Open core, open source, what's the difference? Does it matter? We started talking a little bit about this before we started recording, Sam. My take was open core is becoming a little bit of a hotter commodity around the startup and the investing scene in Silicon Valley. Open source has had its day. People say, broadly speaking, hard to make money, can't figure out the business model. What's your take on what's happening both in the new companies and products that are being offered and in sort of the big industry stuff that's already underway?
For me, it's quite binary. We've put a lot of effort into establishing the open source initiative. We have the open source definition. There's a process. There's a bunch of licenses which are pre-approved. And you can be very clear. It's either open source today, capital O, capital S, or it's not. And that's something that's very clear. And I think that tomorrow, going forward, as we move from products to services, IT as a product to IT as a service, we need to have the same thing for cloud. So open cloud, we need to know it's either open cloud or it's not.
And so just give us your definition so people can say, so what would be included in open cloud and what would be excluded from open cloud?
Well, so for me, and I spent a fair bit of time over the last year or two looking at what's involved, what the important points are. There's basically 4 points, one of which is you need to have open interfaces. Another is you need to have open formats. That's basically it. As long as you've got an open interface or an open protocol to access an open format. So, for example, you can use AtomPub to access Google Docs and you can get your document in an open format like OpenDocument or something like this. Then that, for me, is open cloud. Now, open source is absolutely not essential. It's good to have if you can have it, but it's certainly less relevant, I think, today than what it was previously. And then open data as well is a nice to have too. So, if you look at something like Wikipedia, they've got open protocols, they've got open formats, they're running on open software, and the data itself is licensed under Creative Commons. So that's basically as free as you get in a cloud service.
Yeah. I mean, I see this open core thing as a solution to solving the how do you make money in open source issue, particularly in the startup community. Like, we'll have an open core, and then we'll have the value adds on top of it.
I think that the fundamental thing that open source advertised it was a common engineering platform, that there was somehow this genius of crowds that you would open source it and then engineering would come in. And I think open core, when you start to put the important things, example, Eucalyptus is more scalable model is closed and you have to pay for it.
Clustering with MySQL could be another
example. Yeah, I mean, when you start to go to the open core model, it really is about open source as a marketing medium of freemium. It's shareware all over again, right? It's like, here's the free version. The good stuff is in this thing that you can't play with. And I think that is the death of open source as it was originally constituted and imagined.
Right.
I agree. I think that the way I see it is there's a real struggle in software right now to try to create price tiering. Because there are some people out there with software engineers and build your own solutions going at 150, 200K a year fully loaded. People are willing to pay a lot of money for software that really works and drives their business. On the other hand, you've got people who really won't pay that much money. They're kicking the tires. They want to try stuff out. And as a business person, you need to create tiering in your pricing. But it's just one piece of software that does everything.
Yeah.
What are you going to do? And then the next problem you've got is unless it's open source, nobody really likes it. It's in bad odor. I think we've all felt that open source is, in some philosophical way, the right thing to do. Okay, so you've got people who want to buy your software. You've got people who don't want to buy your software. How do you create a tier and not end up making a whole bunch of products and a whole bunch of complexity for yourself? And even worse, breaking the APIs. So you've got some APIs that are paid APIs and some of which are open. Oh, my gosh, it's a whole mess. On the other hand, you really need to create a tier.
Is this open washing? I mean, cloud always gets... Cloud always gets beat up for a lot of cloud washing going on.
Is open core
open
washing?
Look, I think it is.
I agree. I in some ways, I'm happy about it because as a software developer who likes to get paid, I want a model for livelihood.
Gas to get here wasn't free?
No, it wasn't. There was no open gas. I could go to the open gas station and get my open source gas.
Isn't that why we've seen the shift to selling the service and not the software? Because I say service, you think... service, I pay for the service, and that's the solution, whether it's open core, open source, or not. I mean, isn't that the end game, that people are just going to sell the service and not necessarily the underlying infrastructure?
That was the rudimentary early thinking, and I think the final end state is going to be much more complex.
Are you calling it rudimentary?
I'm sorry, Gary.
It's okay.
No, I'm saying that's the reflex thinking that, oh, we'll start selling it as a service. But look at Eucalyptus. Does Eucalyptus have a cloud offer, or do they actually try to sell a closed source?
They sell services or
they do not
or
sell
commercial support.
Eucalyptus as a service. That would
no, not as a service. They sell support services for Eucalyptus, which is different.
The old school method, which is that if enough people love you, they'll pay your professional services money, etc.
So part of the problem that old model that you just sell everything as a service is there's still the issue of locality. I still care where the service is located because of latency issues. And sometimes I care enough, I want to say, I want your service, no, here. I mean, this close. I want it really right here. And unless you postulate a open fabric where every single service exists within that fabric and can be provisioned over here and everyone supports that, at some point you're going to run into a business problem and say, yes, I like what you're doing, but it can't be I'm happy to interact with it as a service, pay for it as a service, but it needs to be here in my data center.
Well, that depends on the application. I mean, look, if you're New York Times and you want to convert your public domain content to PDF or whatever it is, you don't care where it is.
Absolutely.
Have at it on Hadoop on EC2.
Exactly.
Sam, what's the answer to get out of this open core, open source mess? What's the things people can do to sort of move forward?
I mean, I think that if you look at the history of open source, the reason open source exists at all was to find a happy medium between free software, which is all about freedoms, and this is the Free Software Foundation and RMS and so on, and proprietary software. And proprietary software is not necessarily inherently evil any more than selling a MacBook or a car is inherently evil. The open source was meant to basically put a line in the sand, this is open, this is not, and allow people to make money. You know, there's a whole lot of options for making money. You can sell documentation, you can sell services, you can sell add-ons. You know, there's a whole lot of things that you can do. But if it doesn't meet that set of the open source definition, it's not open source, you know, and you can basically forget about calling it open.
There we go. End of June was a big month for infrastructure. We had the Structure Conference, the Velocity Conference, the DevOps Day, the Hadoop Summit the week after, tons of stuff going on. James, any takeaways from the Structure Conference at a high level?
I think that Om is a very sensitive to trends, and you work with him even closer than I do, and he's very sensitive to what's hot and what's not.
The whole team is, yeah.
They really are good doves in the cave for trends, and they continue. The cloud did not go away like at Structure this year. Like, it could have been that it was sort of a one-hit wonder last year. Everyone was talking about cloud, and it was still there.
This is the third year in a row, yeah.
Yeah, it's still there, and it's still dominating. That's a very high-level takeaway. But
when you sat back, as you do sometimes, and said, okay, what are my takeaways? What am I paying attention to now that I went to this show? And what's now in the back of your mind for the next couple of years? I'll tell you what mine were. Two of my things that I took away from the Structure Conference, which I heard more than once as sort of hot topics. One is OpenFlow. And I'm a huge networking fan, and I think that's really interesting. And it's a ways to go before that's a commercialized technology. But I think the ability to have software-defined or software-enabled networks and tweak things at the network level is big. I don't believe that 10,000 servers magically coalesce inside a data center. There's work and hard work and technology that takes place there. And I think OpenFlow in a couple of years may be a really important component of that. And the other thing, which is an old technology, which I think is making a comeback, is MPLS, multi-protocol label switching. And I heard there were a lot of people from AT&T at the show, and I hosted a panel with a couple of folks from AT&T and EMC Atmos. The thing that we're going to see, in my opinion, is the public cloud providers or the storage as a service providers or the folks who are targeting enterprise are going to push them away from public internet access and towards doing stuff with MPLS so they get the network service and the guaranteed service that they are used to. And I think we're going to see a little resurgence of private or specialized networking services for those enterprises that want to pay for it.
I'm going to point at Sam first.
So that was my takeaway.
I like this term enterprise cloud, and I'd really like to tee him up on this topic.
Oh, look, I mean, I think one of the greatest advantages of cloud computing comes from it being broadly accessible, so it being basically internet connected. You know, we've amused ourselves for a very long time, basically decades now, simply from passing packets from one edge node to another. I mean, really, you know, the servers of yesterday, client server, it was very kind of point to point. And what we're basically doing now is we're adding these big power stations to the core of the network, this intercloud idea. And so I don't think moving away from the internet protocols is really going to happen outside of a high-performance computing environment or something like, you know, a virtual private cloud, the VPC product.
Yeah, but for the Fortune 100 in the United States that have big IT budgets,
none of them use wide-open internet for transport that matters to them.
Yeah, and I think...
And that's the buying behavior that's already there. And so if you start to look at building competitive clouds, one of the first things you can do is, well, you're using quality of service assured transport. You notice how this quality of service thing keeps coming up?
Imagine that.
It's like, that's the big debate in cloud, right? Is good enough good enough? I mean, that's this year.
Well, another thing is that this is all abstracted. And from a user's point of view, you don't care if we use carrier pigeons as long as my quality of service is met.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll agree too. A lot of what I hear as enterprise, as a guy who sells a database which is enterprise class, we don't sell to enterprises. We sell to 30 and 40 person companies who have aspirations of being the next Google and are talking about, no, we really, really need 0.2 milliseconds, and they're very strict about their quality. So they buy enterprise-grade gear and enterprise-grade switches just because they want this particular quality of service. That's what enterprise has come to mean with the people I talk to, is this particular quality of service.
The
has nothing to do with enterprise.
I think the bar for IT in the world of consumerized, you know, consumerization of IT only goes up, right? The people are impatient, short attention span people, and that things have to really work fast, and there has to be performance. And that juxtaposed against good enough is always where the kind of the fun tension is.
I'm not sure I believe. You look at a lot of different services that are extraordinarily popular. One of my fun ones is Flickr. Flickr's got to be the largest photo sharing site, right? How many times on
Facebook
Flickr,
is now?
Facebook is 10x. Facebook publicly quoted that they are bigger than all the other photo sharing services combined.
In terms of number of photos. But anyway, Flickr's still huge.
Flickr's huge. And how often do you click on something in Flickr and wait 2 to 3 seconds?
Too often.
Now, the fact that they're still SQL-based, I could throw rocks at that. But the fact is...
And John Allspaugh left Flickr, famously. one of the kings of DevOps, did leave Flickr.
But I was looking at, for example, Picasa, with, you know, all of the great Google scale technologies, and that thing just...
Picasa's snappy.
It is super snappy. It's got all the range of technologies Google's thrown at it, and yet there's Flickr still soaking up the page views, soaking up the clicks. So maybe people don't really care that occasionally there's a 2 to 3 to 4 second or you click and nothing even happens at all.
Well, at a consumer level service, there's a lot more leeway for that. But when you're measuring latency response times for an enterprise class B2B messaging network between suppliers and partners and distribution channels, I mean, that is much more connected to revenue that enterprises will, and they have a mindset of like, this is the SLA we want. This is the SLA we're going to measure against. There's a handful of startups who will help them measure it. I mean, that stuff is real.
I think in enterprise buyers, you can't forget that these people want not to get fired.
Yes.
And things like MPLS ensure quality of service so that people don't get fired and therefore can put their kids through college.
Well, one of the other things to look at as well is that a lot of the cloud services are very consistent. You know, I mean, something like S3 is not the fastest service in the world. Picasa may not be the fastest service in the world either. I mean, it's pretty damn fast, but it's Rackspace Cloud is a good one. Okay, your latency on some of those requests can actually take a while, but it's very consistent.
Predictably slow.
Yeah, well, I didn't say it was slow. I said, you know, there's a bit of latency there while it loads you up and so on. But once it's going, you know, it's consistently that speed, and that's very important. And if you look at the scoreboard and actually do some tests, like the Royal Pingdom did, I think, the monitoring guys, you know, the uptime for these services is just amazing.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I ran a site called TrustSAS for a while there that was backed onto those guys. And, I mean, we're talking like 3, 4, 5 nines, no worries.
Cool. Let's move on to the next section of the show. I want to talk about shows and meetups. There's a lot of stuff going on next week with OSCON. Sam, you're going. Brian, are you going?
Can't make it.
James, are you going?
I will be going to the Cloud Summit.
Okay. Sam, give us an overview of OSCON and some of the other activities that are going to take place that week. I believe it starts July 19th in Portland, Oregon. So tell us what you're looking forward to up there.
Okay. So look, I fly in on Monday night. We've got a cloud camp organized there. And the focus of that, looking at site here, it's all talks must be related to open source or openness. So I'm going to talk about open cloud. We've got Adrian Cole, who's unfortunately not with us today, but he's going to talk about open source cloud APIs. So I think that's going to be, provided I get there in time, it's going to be an interesting night. And then the next day, of course, we've got the Cloud Summit. And at the Cloud Summit, I'm going to be discussing with Ben Black on the subject of what we need are standards in the cloud. So do standards matter in the cloud? Are they important or a pointless waste of time? Which is more likely to inhibit innovation rather than benefit it? And we've then got a panel of guys from eBay and CSE, Keys of FT and Redmonk and so on, who are going to then synthesize that, plus a whole lot of similar items.
It is no doubt the go-to event for July. So that is by the time the show comes out, it might be too late if you haven't booked your tickets yet. But if OSCON is anything like the wave of infrastructure conferences we saw at the end of June, and in the spirit of openness, I'm hoping that the majority of the content will be available streaming and online. Isn't it amazing how you can pretty much attend a conference from afar now? I mean, you couldn't do that 5 years ago.
It's fantastic. It's not a very cloud topic, but I mean, I'm even a huge fan of like MIT open source some of its classes a while ago.
Yeah.
I love that stuff because I like the idea that someone who's interested in learning and engaged in learning can better themselves.
Yeah.
And that comes down to people like me. I mean, I learn from watching these things every day. I think the knowledge acquisition that's required to compete in this market is huge, and I think it's just a huge benefit to all of us in terms of openness that these are available.
All right, any more topics before we jump into cloud tips and one particular shout out for a valued listener? Any other big topics that we want to cover before we move on? Okay, we're going to do cloud tips in a second. I want to give a shout out to Jeremy Osborne, J-Roz on Twitter.
J-Roz,
woohoo! Sent us a nice comment on enjoying the roundtables, and we really thank him for his support and all of our listeners for their support. So we'll have a link to Jeremy's Twitter handle, and he does some web development work. We'll have a link to that, too, in the show notes. Cloud Tips, chance for us to share interesting companies, services, products, things coming up in and around cloud. So everybody will, you have yours ready, James? Or do you want me to go first?
You can go ahead, Gary, but I got one fired up for you.
Okay, well, you go first.
My cloud tip of the week or the month is to Sowasta, who I've just been hanging out with, learning more and more. And I think what's really cool about them is they're both a front-end cloud-based workload generator as well as a big data company on the back end to actually understand all of that giant, you know, bigger order of magnitude test that you just did. And so they've taken two unique things, which is you could never test this big before and you could never generate that much data before, and they've kind of brought them together and are making a pretty interesting business out of them. And I think hats off to someone that can use cloud and big data in the same business effectively.
Cool. Brian, do you have a cloud tip?
Simplest Store. So these guys are, pretty sure I got the name right.
That's right.
They are doing a tiered data solution. And the idea is a good self-managing solution that says, you know, here's my memory, here's my SSDs, here's my rotational, and here is my back-end massive cloud on the back side, being able to manage all of that tier transparently. So I think it's a great way to get your feet wet with larger data sets.
Do you mean Store Simple?
Store Simple, excuse
me. Store Simple is run by a man named Rashid, who is a friend of the show, friend of both Gary and I.
I had no idea.
Hats off to him. I had drinks with him when he was just starting this. He left Cisco to do it. And
Store Simple.
Has built a monster targeting very specific workloads is the one thing that they do very well. Like they say, for Microsoft Exchange, we will be all you need.
Sam, do you have a cloud tip for the show?
So look, I guess my cloud tip, we've been talking about open cloud for a while now. I think things there are going to start really heating up. You know, we're talking about it on Monday night from 7 at OSCON. We've got all day Tuesday we're talking about it. And on Wednesday night, actually, as well, we've got an open cloud Birds of a Feather session, which will be quite interesting as well. So I think definitely keep an eye on this. There'll be some movement at the station.
My cloud tip for the week is a mini tip. And it's something I've been complaining about for a while in managing the podcast, as well as my personal Google stuff, as well as my work Google stuff, is all this mumbo-jumbo with multiple accounts. I have frequently had to have Safari, Chrome, and Firefox open simultaneously so I can shift between my schizophrenic personalities and manage the Google Docs and the email and the Blogger accounts. And just last week, I saw an announcement that Google is testing multiple account sign-in and changing within a single browser, which cannot come soon enough. I applaud it. It hasn't shown up on my Google account or accounts yet, but as soon as it does, I will be jumping in with both feet, and that's my cloud tip for a week. I got it from a story from Liz Gaines, who writes for GigaOm. I'll put a link in the show notes, and you can watch your accounts accordingly.
Well, look, what I would say on that just quickly is that if you're using something like Chrome, you've got incognito mode, so you can actually start other sessions there as well. Obviously, can't talk about anything
that's a good
that we're
tip.
Working on.
That's a good tip.
The same applies like Safari with private browsing. I believe it maintains separate cookies as well.
Yeah.
So you should be able to use it with any sensible sensible browser.
But there's room for improvement there, I'm looking forward to that.
Do you see what a big pickup Sam was for Google?
Huge.
Do you see what a big pickup he was? So my congratulations to Google on picking up Sam.
Yeah, he just developed a new product by just explaining a feature to me.
Well, the other thing I would mention as well, we all have exactly the same problems as you guys. So, you know, we're all used to using products, we're dog fooding it. So, you know, any problems that you have with it, we have as well.
Good.
Usually long before you do.
Good.
So.
Well, one of these days, we need to get somebody from Google Apps and Google Docs on the show and do a little bit more consumer-oriented show about just using some of these tools.
I have a friend at Google App Engine. I'll try to do it.
So okay, yeah. Good. And if anybody has any recommendations, feel free to let us know. So that we got everybody's cloud tip in? I think so. Let's do a quick roundabout about where people can find us, Twitter addresses, company websites, anything else. We'll start with you, Brian.
Citrusleaf.net, and you'll find our outdated website. We're starting to work more with analytics products and real-time analytics, especially for social networking. So check us out at citrusleaf.net, and I'm Beeble Cow at Twitter.
Great. Sam, give us your info, and then you also work on a couple of initiatives, so give us that detail as well.
Okay, so Sam Johnson, I'm Sam J on Twitter. My neglected blog is at samj.net, and you can email me at sj@google. opencloud.com. So the main one that I'm focusing on at the moment is the Open Cloud Initiative, which would be opencloudinitiative.org.
Great. James.
Yeah, James Waters. Do my last name and then my first name at Twitter, so Waters James with two T's. I guess I can shout out that I do work at VMware on the vCloud Initiative, so if you ever want to try out vCloud Express, just Google that, have a look, tell me what you think.
Great. And I'm Gary Orenstein on Twitter, full name Gary Orenstein. And I want to thank all our listeners for the show. I want to thank Sam for joining us all the way from Zurich. We're really happy that we caught him.
Yeah.
He's leaving town. You're leaving town tomorrow, so we got you squeezed in right at the last moment.
Well, yeah, I'm leaving this part of town, off to Seattle.
Great, great. You can visit us online at thecloudcomputingshow.com. You can email any show suggestions, comments, whatever you have, to thecloudcomputingshow@gmail.com. You can also subscribe on iTunes by searching for The Cloud Computing Show, or click through to the top of our homepage. We have a direct link to the iTunes podcast feed there. Be sure to sign up. And if you're at OSCON, be sure to look for Sam Jay or Waters James. They'll be there walking the floor. Say hi, and we'll see everybody on the next show. Thanks, everyone. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, guys.
Cheers.
Bye.